Welcome back. So as Kim said, I'm going to spend a little bit of time and talk about where the experience of concentration or samadhi as it relates to practice itself and actually being on the cushion. Before I launch into some of that, I'll give a little more background. Also, definition-wise, this stuff is interesting to translate out of the Pali into English and kind of get the real sensibility to it. We've already talked about samadhi a couple times as being translated as concentration, but actually one of the translations that I find most accurate is translated as indistractability. Yeah, it's the ability of the mind to, you know, just really settle down into, you know, observation of, or experience and be able to just rest on that and not be distracted. This is interesting. I think...
Try clipping it. It was actually okay. Better for me when I had it just not moving.
We had this happen with Nikki yesterday.
Okay.
She's very soft-spoken.
I'll turn that down a little also. You have a nice loud voice. So.
I do. Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. I think we're okay, Kim.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I normally have a soft voice.
Oh.
So.
If you can't hear, let me know.
Good to hear. I'm getting better at this. There's another term that you sometimes run across in relationship to samadhi. It's called samatha. And that translates... literally out of the Pali into the, you know, basically calm. Mm-hmm. And it tends to refer to any meditation practice, you know, that creates samadhi. And I've also seen it sometimes used by authors interchangeably with samadhi. So samadhi, samatha, samatha is, you know, equivalencies in my view, you know, when you start to see them in text. So it's an interesting historical context, you know, when you look at concentration that I wanted to share. Actually, you'll find references to concentration many places in the suttas. You know, it's kind of scattered all over the place to the level that it clearly was something that was kind of a given, I think, in the cultural context that the Buddha lived in. It was like, of course, you know, this is something that was going to be practiced if you're a serious spiritual practitioner. At least that's the way it's, you know, kind of portrayed, you know, in the text. And we also know that the Buddha's initial teachers that he worked with, there was two famous meditation teachers that he practiced with. Both of them were known as kind of experts, you know, in jhana and concentration practice. And that's what, you know, he was a very accomplished practitioner with each of them. They both asked him to teach, you know, after he was done practicing with them or, you know, working with them. And, but to their view, the absorbed, concentrated mind was kind of the end goal. But the Buddha... Yeah, intuited or just hit his realization that that's not the end goal. That it was really this springboard for liberating insight. So it had value, but it was a step beyond, you know, that he experienced, you know, beyond just the concentrated mind. So this word jhana is very much associated a lot of times with samadhi and concentration, and it translates actually more directly as just the word meditation. But it's really associated with concentration and samadhi. And higher levels of jhana are subscribed to increasing levels of concentration and undistractability. So the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, there's actually jhanas past that. When you see them in the text, you see these references, you know, that's what it means, these successive levels. It's actually said that at his death, the Buddha basically resided in the fourth jhana, which is interesting. How did he tell them? Maybe they just intuited that. So I think the big leap that the Buddha, you know, gave us was really this understanding that these jhana practices, these concentration practices, are, you know, clearly a valuable part of our path, but they're not the end of the path. You know, it's a springboard. It's a help, you know, in moving into insight practice. So if I talk a little bit about this relationship to mindfulness, I'm just going to kind of reiterate my view of that, because there's been some controversy, I think, over the years, you know, within the mindfulness community about, you know, mindfulness versus concentration. They've been almost talked about as one or the other. But it's very clear, you know, I think in the text, Kim was alluding to this also, and in my own experience, that they're very much something that works well together. You know, they're very complementary. And this whole notion that, you know, one should be practiced without the other, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Especially in the context of mindfulness, where as you practice mindfulness over time, you naturally move, you know, towards having a more concentrated mind. So benefits, you know, cultivating of happiness, stability of mind, equanimity, peace, you know, these are the experiences that can come out of this kind of practice on the cushion. But I think one of the more interesting problems that I've certainly experienced is attachment to those experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the issues that came up early on as Theravada teachings were being brought to the West. You know, students have these experiences and have become attached to them, or start to view them almost like a drug. We just need to be very just mindful of that. That's where the mindfulness comes in. Am I attached to this? Am I striving? Do I have to have this experience and grasp to it? I think one of the more interesting things about, you think about a concentrated mind and as it relates to insight, is that a concentrated mind is a really excellent reflector, you know, of what experience is. So you can just see very clearly, it's like a mirror, you know, you can see very clearly what's placed right before it. When you think of a mirror, it just reflects exactly what is there. And that's kind of what a concentrated mind can do. In a very, you know, kind of non-judgmental kind of way, you just observe experience. And I think that's one of the largest values, you know, that it brings to this notion of insight practice. It's just being able to see very clearly the nature of what's happening around us. Now, it's interesting. In many places I've read about the you know, the path we're discussing today, you know, why samadhi. And it's a lot of times in the text translated as the four jhanas is considered to be that. I think that's somewhat simplistic. You know, there's this whole realm here of how we practice and the concentration that we can experience, you know, in our daily lives. But that is literally what I've seem to find in the suttas, you know, wise concentration for jhanas, which is interesting. One thing to remember, though, is this doesn't occur all at once. You know, this whole experience of samadhi, you know, is something that typically builds over time. And it's very wide differences in my experience, you know, what people actually, you know, experience around concentration. For some folks, it's like very easy to kind of fall into these states. In other folks, it just doesn't happen naturally. You know, it just isn't something that is critical. But it's important to remember that you can have liberating insight without these concentrated states. It's not a requirement. You know, I have to go through this gate, you know, to get to this insight. That's not true. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about now the more of the specifics of these states. So there's a term called access concentration. If you read about jhanas and concentration, you hear this. And it's interesting. It's something that was introduced in the commentaries. You know, they were written after the time of the Buddha. So you won't see it referred to in the suttas, but it's a concept that got added later on. And what it means is being fully with your meditation object. So you've reached a spot, you know, of really being able to, the mind isn't flittering around. It's really kind of settled down on your object of meditation, whatever that is. And there are lots of objects of meditation. In the suttas, there are like 30 different ones that could be used. We focus on the breath, the body sensations, and metta. Yeah, that tends to be what we work with, but in some ways it doesn't matter. You know, it's the absorption into the object. And at this point, the hindrances have subsided. So you're on the object, hindrances are not there. So that becomes kind of the entry point then into then these different levels of jhana. There's a couple of terms here as we talk about jhanas that are important to understand, called piti and sukha. Now, piti is translated as like glee, rapture, ecstasy. But looked at from more of a physical perspective. So think of those things in terms of your body, the feeling in your body. Now, sukha is translated a lot of times as happiness or joy. But think of that in terms of more of the mental side, not the body side. And as you look at what are called the first four jhanas, it's really kind of a gradation of those two things that are occurring, the piti and the sukha. So in the first jhana, both of these are occurring, you know, but there's a predominance of the piti, or the physical kind of aspect of the joy that's occurring. And you know, you may have this experience of this kind of suffusing through the body, this energy in the body. Now, there's thoughts still occurring, right? You may have just random thoughts here and there, so your mind isn't fully kind of stabilized at that point. But it's more in the background. It's not necessarily a calm state, you know, because you got all this body energy that's occurring. And sometimes it actually can be a little bit unpleasant. You know, you can have this like boy, you know, my body's going crazy kind of feeling. I think this is related from a Hindu perspective to this notion of the awakening of the kundalini. You know, there's just this body energy that just kind of arises, and it can be a little unnerving. And remember, these succession of moving through the jhanas is something that kind of somewhat naturally occurs. There's not a whole lot of, you know, will associated with this. It's more of a continuing letting go into the experience, and then somewhat naturally you move through these. And even though they sound like there's this like perfect sequence, that actually, you know, in real experience, you can sometimes jump around. So all of a sudden you're in this first jhana, and you have these experiences in the third or the fourth jhana. So it's not a strict kind of mathematical kind of experience. So in the second jhana, the thoughts are really starting to subside. So the mind is really kind of settling. So there's more tranquility that's building, and the sukha is starting to dominate. So the piti is starting to kind of the, so the body's settling. The body energy is not so kind of frenetic. One way to describe it is like a kind of a cool spring filling a lake. You know, it's just kind of coming up from the underneath, just this cool calmness. And moving into the third jhana, the pitti disappears pretty much. So now you're left with a sukha, you know, just this pure kind of mental happiness. This occurring, you know, kind of satisfaction or happiness just really kind of stabilizing. I've heard people describe this as, this is where the smile on the Buddha comes from. Have you ever noticed that on the Buddha statue? It's this certain smile. And I thought that was very true. And the fourth jhana, there's this real quiet stillness kind of predominates. So both of this, the pitti and the sukha, really kind of subside. And it is kind of deep sense of equanimity. And the mind, you know, just getting very one-pointed. Just real kind of dropping down experience. You know, it's like you really kind of go into the experience of your body. Your feeling of sensations outside of you is disappearing. Sometimes described as kind of going into a cave. You really go deep into this. It's kind of hard to put into words, as you notice, this great stillness. You can kind of have this kind of bright light kind of suffusing the mind. You can have some, you know, kind of a light show along the way here. But, you know, predominantly it's this experience of being in kind of a cocoon, you know, in this really tranquil place. And this is said to be the kind of the base point for then insight practice, you know, is really in this fourth jhana, in this very still kind of place, to then, you know, potentially have the arising of insights, you know, or contemplate, you know, particular insights. Now, there are other different states of consciousness that are in the suttas. In fact, in talking to one of my teachers, Lee Brazington, he said he's found like 25 or 30 different descriptions of different states of consciousness inside the suttas. They're different than what I just described to you. So, it's interesting. You know, there's a whole bunch of this stuff out here. And, you know, talking to people that I know that practice this and have been on concentration retreats, you know, the variances in what people experience, you know, are kind of all over the board in the specifics. A lot of them follow these same kind of patterns and have these experiences, so I think the descriptions are valid, but then on an individual level, you know, there might be some real variances. So there are another set of four jhanas, or the higher jhanas, after the first four. And they're a little trippy, quite honestly. There's the realm of infinite space, the realm of limitless consciousness, the realm of no-thingness, and the realm of perception, non-perception. As a point of, like, description, those things are out there. But the interesting thing was that I found in investigating this for myself was that, the Buddha, you know, basically said this: you reach this level of tranquility, you know, inside of the fourth jhana, you know, that's really what's sufficient, you know, for insight practice. So all this other stuff, don't get too distracted by it. It may occur or not occur. That's, you know, okay. But the level of stability of mind reached in the fourth jhana was what he found of value. I think we'll stop there. I could spend the rest of the afternoon talking about this stuff. It's pretty fascinating. There are many books written. Kim already mentioned Shala Catherine. There's another teacher who used to teach here, Richard Shankman. has written books on concentration. One of my teachers, Lee Brazington, got a great, I think probably the best book in my view on concentration. And there's another teacher named Manjan Brahm, teaches out of Australia, that's written about concentration. So just, if you're curious, you can, you know, there's plenty to read out there. So I think I'll wrap it up there. And let's see, I guess we'll go into our breakout sessions again. Do we have the same number of people?
Yes.
Same groups?
Same groups?
Actually, we only have 11 now.
Yeah, we lost one person. We can do a group of two if that works.
Okay.
Yeah. Or four.
Yeah. So I could go into the groups and then I'll throw out the questions. Okay, so at times when you've experienced a calm and collected mind, what sensations and feelings are present? And what value do these have to you? So again, at times when you've experienced a calm and collected mind, what sensations and feelings were present when that occurred? And what value do these have to you?
What
value did they have to you? What value did you find?
Value.